The first question is this. In The Rake's Progress, the devil is called Nick Shadow for obvious reasons. In other operas, such as The Faust, he's Mephistopheles. What do we understand by this, and what does the difference signify?
Well, I think the reason that Auden chose the name Nick Shadow is the devil is often referred to as Old Nick. And the idea is that in The Rake's Progress, he tends to shadow everything that Tom does. So he actually, musically and dramatically, is seen to persuade Tom to do certain things, to encourage Tom to behave in a certain way, and then follow him through that particular behavioural pattern. So as Tom's journey begins, Nick is always there at his side. And even in the opera, he says that with a shadow to guide. So the concept of shadowing also, I think, has implications for dark. And the Nick is an obvious one. So I think further to that is that all the characters are given names which associate closely with their particular manners of behaving. So Anne is called Anne True Love because she truly loves. Her father is not called Mr. True Love, he's called Father True Love. And everything he does is absolutely fatherly. Nick Shadow is clearly the devil, and Tom Rakewell indicates that he is well-schooled as a rake or becomes well-schooled as a rake. And the auctioneer, who appears later, is called Sellem, Sellem. And then later, of course, we have the one character who is not necessarily named appropriately as far as her behaviour is concerned, but who is an extraordinary character, is Baba the Turk, who is the bearded lady who appears at St. Giles Fair. So Nick, the character of the devil, I've only done three pieces where there have been a devil. Mephistopheles, The Damnation of Faust, in which the devil is called Mephistopheles. Gounod's Faust, which is again Mephisto. And Angélique by Ibert, in which the devil finishes up with Angélique in hell, and the devil can't stand her, and so he sends her back. So that's the one opera I know where the devil is defeated. But that's my view on that particular one.
It's interesting, Richard, looking at the devil in those different works. I think in most works depicting Mephistopheles or the devil, he's a very cheery sort of fellow. He's good fun to be with, and Nick Shadow is too. And he's always witty and smart and clever and good company. He's a little less of that in Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. He's a more gloomy sort of character, and I think his most wonderful line in that play, Faust says, "Well, if you are the devil, why aren't you in hell?" And Mephisto says, "Why, this is hell, nor am I out of it." In other words, we always carry our hell with us. We create our own hell, and wherever we go, we carry it with us. But I think the most wonderful devil of all, of course, is Milton's Lucifer, who is not witty or sharp or funny. He's a great, tragic, gloomy character full of despair and vengeance. He wants to destroy the whole of creation in return for having been thrown out of paradise and having fallen so far. He's like the great devil, I suppose, whereas Mephistopheles and Nick Shadow are sort of minor devils in a way. They're, you know, junior league compared to Lucifer.
I once interviewed a professor from America who thought that the devil had had a bad press, that in fact the idea of the devil is... the idea of everything negative is only from the second century on, that in the Bible he is God's tester or prover, as in the story of Job and so forth. And it's certainly true that in the first centuries he wasn't portrayed in art. Why is that so, Laurie, and what changed, and how is he portrayed now?
Oh, I'll take one question at a time. A lot of it is about the dichotomies of life and the values of good and evil, and as there was almost a necessity to image the evil side of humanity, I think that's what sparked off artists. So clearly over the centuries, as the image of the devil changed, I think that was really about changing society. And so it was artists reflecting what was happening in society, and so they had to image the devil gradually, and then I think it really did explode more in the 18th and 19th centuries, where they do image the devil in the guises that we now understand. But you know, very early on, there was sort of traditional images were of the snake and then of the horned devil and whatever. But I think the interesting thing with the 18th century, and this is I think a really interesting departure with the Hogarth's Rake's Progress and the subsequent play and the ballet, etc., is that Nick Shadow's not in any of the prints, is not in Hogarth's imagination at all. I think what the devil and the evil in Hogarth's paintings and the subsequent prints is that it's society. There's something inherent in Tom's character that makes him evil, and the moral of the story is that the idle hands are the devil's playground. Now, you know, that there's that, and yet the playwrights and Stravinsky and Auden had to give that a specific character. And that they had to actually invent Nick's shadow, and so Hogarth is really a starting point for the opera and the ballet. And I find that quite interesting that they need to latch on to, or the playwrights have to latch on to a character. Well, they can't really express the evil around Tom and coming from within Tom. It's much easier, and I think this is where the imaging of the devil in art and society is so important, because the devil's not an invention of the Judeo-Christian religion. There are in all religions and in all societies there are these opposing forces. There are evil spirits in Australian Indigenous culture. There are devils and evil spirits in Egyptian culture, and there are little characteristics in the Islamic world and Southeast Asian worlds. There are elements of the devil, elements of the evil spirits, to explain the evils that humanity do to one another. And yet, though the devil is certainly imaged stronger in the Christian religion than any other, I think that's where that single character is really focused on. And I think that's where the imaging, the changing and the strengthening of the imaging of the devil from very early images and then really in the 19th and 20th centuries with images of Hogarth and Blake. And here's a more benign devil. The devil has different guises, as John indicated, that the devil or Mephistopheles or Lucifer have different characteristics, and some are more benign and some are more overt. But it really sparks the artist's imagination, and they can carry this imagery on anywhere. It's the great Delacroix, Mephistopheles flying over, spreading the plague into Wittenberg, and wonderful images Robert Mapplethorpe bringing into the 20th century. That's different. That's a sculpture of the devil, but you can sense Mapplethorpe's hand in that. And it's still with us. This is happening. These imaging of the devil, and it's still with us, and it's still relevant, which is why you guys are doing the opera, because this battle between good and evil is always around us, even in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so it's the imaging is still with us, still relevant, and as I said, that's why this opera is being returned to again.
John, you were talking about the devil being gloomy at worst, really, in most representations. Why is that? Why is it that that we associate vice and the devil and such subjects with wit and cleverness, and goodness is dull, and virtue, of course, are dull and boring? Something we all know deep in our hearts, at least in the literary realm. Can you explore that a little bit more?
Well, I suppose we all love the outlaw figure, whether it's Robin Hood or Ned Kelly. Or any other outlaw character, we have an admiration for somebody who avoids the 9-to-5 drudgery and respectability and dares to be a free spirit and break all conventions and laws and have a wonderful time. As long as they get caught in the end, of course, that's the important thing. They have to pay for their crimes. That's why we like, Italian movies like The Godfathers and The Goodfellas and The Sopranos. We're fascinated by evil. And I think we, because it's part of our DNA. I mean, I think we evolved from a you know, the killer apes, and we're still evolving, hopefully, and getting a little better. But it's part of us, and it's healthy to acknowledge it and say, yes, the evil is in us. I guess one of my favourite roles is Prospero in The Tempest. I've done it three times now, and I love the play, I love the role. And Prospero is a great magician. He's banished to an island with his daughter, and he has two servants. He has Ariel, who is his kind of imagination, his creativity, his aspiring after beauty and art, and Caliban, who is a monster, who is incestuous and murderous and drunken and vengeful. And Prospero keeps them both under tight control. He won't let go of Ariel, and he can't do without Caliban. They're both parts of himself. And at the end of the play, he's able to return, to leave his island and return to humanity only after he has freed his spirit, his imagination, his creativity, and forgiven his enemies and acknowledged Caliban. And he says, "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine," which is my favourite line in the play. "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine." That once we acknowledge the darkness in ourselves and admit to it, then we are free to move on. And I guess that's what we do with drama. We create, we give this evil in us, which is in us, all of us, it's there. And we have to admit that and let it out for a while and give it a name, call it Lucifer or Satan or Richard III or Count Dracula or Freddy Krueger or whatever. And give it a name, and then we can let it have a stroll around and have a good time, and then we have to put it back in the bottle again. It has to get executed or caught or banished or something. We have to. But it's a healthy thing to admit to it and let it out and say, yes, we do enjoy evil. It's the thing we have to acknowledge, as long as it's kept in check and is put in its place eventually.
So it's a sort of sublimation.
Yes, and it's good not to sublimate it. It's good to admit to it and externalise it.
What about in music, Richard? For example, Boito's Mephistopheles, which you referred to, he's a very jovial character, and he goes whistling around in that aria when he thinks about his creed and so forth. Explain that to us. Why the devil's a cheerful fellow in music?
I think it was Wesley said, "Why should the devil have all the good tunes?" when he was talking about hymns. And in Boito, of course, he whistles. The devil does this spectacular whistling. But the whistling isn't necessarily always good. And the point that John is making about the devil in us and the devil being released, in music, it was, in the early Christian church, an extremely dangerous thing to write music which contained what was known as the devil's interval, or the intervallus diabolus. And the devil's interval was... known or is known as the augmented fourth or the diminished fifth. It's a tritone. I'm going to try and sing it for you. Sorry, John. John's been listening to me sing in the rehearsal room and he's so tolerant. So the interval is, if you know Maria from West Side Story, Maria, that's a tritone. Ta, and that interval was banned for about 250 years by the Catholic Church as being potentially harmful in music. And the reason it was considered harmful was it wasn't perfect. You have a series, if you play fourths up the piano like C to F, ba ba, da di, da ta, ta ti, there's your devil's interval. And so they changed that sound with another note, which they called a false note. And that was the evolution of a style known as musica ficta, false music, because it changed the way the scale moved. So the devil was prevalent in music for a long, long time. And a lot of music was written at that time in triple meter, because the triple meter, or the three time signature, was seen as the Trinity. And therefore, if you had a time signature which had God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost, there was no way the devil could get in. So that fear of the devil has been extraordinary in the Catholic Church, particularly associated with music. But from the Boito and that, his Mephisto and all that other sort of thing, these devils are jolly happy characters. Like, for example, the devil in Gounod's Faust is a, you know, he mixes with the students, he has drinks with them, and he takes them on jolly trips and all that sort of thing. And so everyone's persuaded by the devil. They think, you know, he's a super, super guy. They just don't know really who he is. The tragedy, though, with the devil in the Gounod and the Berlioz is that Marguerite is totally unaware. And I have a theory about this in relationship to the Rake's Progress. I know this is a sort of a digression, but when Stravinsky was writing The Rake's Progress, he was listening to Così fan tutte every day, and Gluck's Orfei, and there are references to those two works right through the piece. Now, I would love to know, and I'm going to find out one day when I meet Stravinsky face to face, whether he based the character of Nick Shadow on Don Alfonso in Così, who manipulates the girls and the boys in the most terrible way, producing probably Mozart's most misogynistic work, where four human lives are totally brought asunder by this character called Don Alfonso. And I'm wondering whether Stravinsky and Auden thought, we can use someone like that and call him Nick Shadow. It's a theory. It's something one could talk about over a drink, but it's the fact that it's so Così-ridden. There are big chunks, quotes from Così, and even Un Ora Amorosa, when Tom sings about the song about love, a direct quote from the finale to Act 1 of Così. So one day I'll ask Stravinsky those questions, and he'll probably say, mind your own business.
And, of course, Maria was no better than she should be, was she, with that devil's interval?
Indeed.
What attracts, Laurie, what attracts artists to portray the devil in any form?
I'd love to just say sex and sexiness, but that's far too simple. It is the great role, a role of the visual artist in any society is to visually articulate what is happening in that society, what is important to that society. Now, as John alluding, the devil is all around us, and humanity does have this dark side. So, a role of the visual artist is to visually define and to visually describe what's happening in that society. And of course, the fight between good and evil is going on. And the other flip side of that, as you see with Hogarth, he is really doing it on a really broad societal aspect, whereas a lot of artists do internalise it and they're actually fighting out their own demons. Because there's no autobiography, I think, in Hogarth's Rake's Progress. Move about a couple of hundred years later, and David Hockney's version of the Rake's Progress is purely autobiographical. He does a series of prints of the Rake, of his own Rake's Progress as he develops as an artist, which is quite interesting. And so, you know, artists themselves are really wrestling with this, with their own demons, with their own form of expression, and I think that's what keeps the image alive, and that's what keeps it alive for artists. And I also, in terms of acting and expressing, I remember reading that Jack Nicholson sent a warning to Heath Ledger, who was about to play one of the evilest characters in cinema, which is the Joker in Batman, who Jack Nicholson already played, and he sent a warning to Heath Ledger that this character can actually consume you. This character can eat into your soul and eat into your spirit. So I'm going to now a question about notice for John, who has also played Mephistopheles. He's also directing Nick Shadow. But I think, John, you could probably answer Barney's question better, because you're directing the devil and you've played the devil. So please, let us know.
Well, look, it just boils down to being good fun, I'm afraid. It's as simple as that. It's a great dramatic role. That's the Mephistopheles in... that's cobbled together out of Goethe's Faust and Marlowe's Dr. Faustus was a bit of an amalgam, that particular role. But I suppose Richard III is another very good example. And I've played that a couple of times too, and it's a wonderful role to play because he has such a conspiratorial relationship with the audience, and he seduces the audience, and he gets them on side, and the audience actually can get a bit upset that they are sort of conspiring with this person against the other characters in the play, and they're letting on all his secrets and what he's going to do and how much fun he's having doing it. And it's true that a character like Mephistopheles or Richard III have this sense of freedom and no moral obligations, no ties to anybody. And we do rather envy that vicariously, that they can have this fantastic run and unimpeded. But of course they have to pay for it in the end. That's the important thing. I can't think of any great work of literature where the evil character gets away with it. I think we'd find that too disturbing.
That's a really interesting point, because Mephistopheles in Faust is a more benign character. He actually warns Faust what he's in for, which Nick Shadow certainly doesn't. But there are other interpretations of Mephistopheles in Faust, because Faust isn't just Goethe. There's dozens and dozens of explorations of the Faust character and Mephistopheles. Sometimes Mephistopheles wins. I mean, and there is no redemption, which is, of course, incredibly damning for society. It's not just the individual. Now Mephistopheles is a little bit more benign. He's a nicer worker for the devil. He is only a worker for the devil. He's not the devil himself or herself. And so there's the differences between Nick in Nick Shadow. Nick obviously loses in the opera.
Rex Progress. Everybody loses in the Rex Progress. Nick does gamble with Tom for his soul. And Tom is saved from damnation, but he is sent insane, whereas Nick loses everything. He's taken this great investment in Tom, and he loses the card game, and so he's banished back to hell in great torment. So he's a loser too. I guess the thing about the Rake's Progress, where the opera is so different to the Hogarth, is that the Hogarth series of prints and paintings is very bitter, very cynical, merciless. It's a wonderful exploration of English society as Hogarth saw it. And he's absolutely unsparing about people's hypocrisy and sentimentality. It's a marvellous piece of art. But in the Rake's and the Rake in that series is he's a pretty sort of weak character. He just is a total gull. He falls for every trick, and it's just a downward spiral. In the Stravinsky Auden version, there's more compassion in the work, in that Tom isn't a bad guy at all. He's a bit feckless. He's a bit thoughtless, and Nick really leads him to damnation, or on the road to damnation all the way. And Tom keeps falling for all these various tricks. But he keeps having fits of remorse and guilt, and he wants to do good. He wants to restore himself in Anne's favour. So there is this constant attempt at redemption in this version, which I find very reassuring. And there is Anne's true love does really shine through at the end, and I think redeems the whole piece in a way that Hogarth never even attempted to do.
Nice. No fun, Hogarth.
John, I would kick myself if I didn't ask you this question, although it's very tangential indeed. Have you ever played any character whose cruelty or evil disturbed you, and how did you cope with that?
Well, I suppose Richard III, for instance, is not very disturbing in that it's such a externalised character. He does talk to the audience a lot. He tells them what he's going to do. He's almost unrepentant. There's a little bit of regret, shall I say, rather than repentance towards the end. The character I find very disturbing to play, and I think most actors do, is Macbeth, who has no sense of humour at all. And it's absolutely guilt-ridden from the beginning, and is tortured with hallucinations and nightmares. And that's a very disturbing part to play, because you've got to put yourself into the mindset of someone who can commit these horrendous murders for a start, some sort of serial killer or, you know, perverted sadist who can do these things, and then you've got to sort of identify and live through the agony of regret and the sureness of damnation. He knows that he's going to hell at the end, and it's you know, a very gloomy journey to go on.
Oh, thank you for that. Richard, what does one imagine an artist might achieve in or hope to achieve in telling stories about the devil?
I think one of the things about the theatre and the drama is that it brings you in into touch with the reality. And it's why we have nursery rhymes for children, and we hope children do read nursery rhymes, and they do deal with good and evil in nursery rhymes. And they do in fairy stories. There is good and evil in fairy stories, and I think that's a way in which we come to touch, we come to meet reality and how we deal with it. And so the good and evil sets up moral dilemmas for us. And we need to know how, through the characters in the story, how these moral dilemmas are solved. And in The Rake's Progress, it's very clear what's going on and what's going to happen at the end and how that is solved. And then, in true Enlightenment style, the characters step forward as an epilogue and say, good people, just a moment. What you have seen here doesn't always necessarily happen in real life. Not every Tom has an Anne to rescue him. And the devil says, well, sometimes I get so fed up, I wish I wasn't the devil. And so on. So we have that sort of Enlightenment thing at the end. And I think what I get from that is that the theatre allows you to watch people go through a series of actions and reactions to each other from which we can make deductions. And it was never more potently brought home to me than recently when we did our pantomime and we started to get things from children like, I did not like the ugly sisters, they were cruel to Cinderella. I thought Buttons was very funny. Does Tickety Boo really exist? Would she come and see me? How do you become like Tickety Boo? Which I love. I just think it's fantastic that the children are engaged so deeply in these stories. And theatre for children is something we've lost, which is why we did the pantomime. So that we can actually bring back, and it was wonderful to do something like that in the Madge, an old-fashioned theatre with a front, with a curtain, and we had 2D scenery and all of those sorts of things. So I think what people get from that is a slice of reality. This is how we deal with the real world through the eyes of a dramatist or a composer. In this particular piece, some of the libretto is so dense. John and I look at each other when we hear lines of Auden, which is beautiful if you're reading the poetry. But there are lines, and there's the famous line, which there's a much discussion in the room, is bowers of paper that only seals repair. And we look at each other and think, well, that's going to change someone's life. So, but in the end, the story does give us that moral take.